Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's been a rough week for UW President Bob Sternberg. He's been taken to task by several UW faculty on university listservs over his handling of a number of issues, but people have expressed the most concern over the turnover of some UW administrators. Most recently, the dismissal of the College of Education dean and the resignation of the law school dean. Sternberg gives us his perspective on the controversy.
Well, the goal I had when I came in was for us to be a top land-grant institution, if not the top land-grant institution, in terms of educating ethical leaders who will make a positive, meaningful, and enduring difference to the world. That was the goal. And any new president needs a team of people who shares their goal, their mission, and how to go about accomplishing it. So what I have been trying to do in my first months as president is to put together a team that could move us forward in terms of that mission of serving the state of Wyoming and serving the people in it. And that's where we've gone. I don't anticipate any more changes.
Now, was it starting with the provost's office? I've been here and have certainly seen people bringing new people in that position. But I think what maybe caught people off guard is you've done a lot of this awfully quickly. Did you feel it was necessary to make those changes right away?
I have made a total of 2 personnel changes since I've come here. Some other people, for reasons of their own, decided to step down. But in terms of my talking to someone about their stepping down or someone on my team talking to someone about stepping down, there have been a total of 2.
But other people, in your view, have just decided they didn't like the direction things are going? Or
no, it's a little more complicated than that. The engineering dean left shortly before I came. But because it was so close to my coming, I sometimes see him as one of the people that I had something to do with. I had nothing to do with that. When I started, the business dean already had an offer from the University of Nevada at Las Vegas for almost double the salary he had here. So before I even started, he was pretty much out the door. So those 2 were really things that happened before my time. The provost, I think that Myron and I probably both felt that we didn't have compatible visions for the university. So that's 1 of the 2. So he stepped down. And that was really, I think, incompatibility. After he stepped down, his staff of associate provosts decided voluntarily to go too, but that was up to them. If they identified very strongly with him and his leadership and felt that, you know, if he goes, they want to go, that was up to them. So the provost was 1. The education dean, I felt that our directions were somewhat different, but dean decisions are actually made by the provost, or in our case, interim dean of academic affairs. So that was the 2nd one that I had something to do with, although I never actually had the conversation with her, the interim dean of VP for academic affairs did. And then recently the law dean stepped down. That was totally his decision. I was really surprised that he did that. So although there have been some changes, I was, I think, directly involved perhaps in 2 of them. In the case of the law dean, he seemed uncomfortable with having an advisory task force that would make some recommendations, or he felt that he should have been more involved in that. The task force is strictly advisory. It has no statutory authority. It has no authority to change anything. There was an allegation in a letter for some law students that industry was running things. I had no pressure from industry. I had no pressure from politicians to do this. It was the result of a conversation between some board members and me that, because I had heard as I went around the state concerns about whether we were as strong in energy and natural resource law as we had been in the past. I thought it would be good to look into that, but I have no basis for knowing whether that's the case or not. I'm not a lawyer, and so I thought it would be useful to have an advisory task force.
I don't know if you look at the listservs or some of the conversation that's been going on campus, but it does strike me that certainly among the faculty there are people troubled with things, wondering what direction you're going. Does that concern you, and is this something that you're necessarily worried about?
It concerns me greatly. And if there are any faculty who have concerns, I really wish deeply that they would come to see me. I have had town meetings. I've had a listening meeting. I have a suggestion box. I have faculty lunches and dinners. I'm willing to meet with anyone anytime about anything. And if they have concerns, please come talk to me and let's discuss them and let's get them resolved.
Well, what do you think people aren't understanding or maybe are missing?
I think they're probably concerned about the rate of change, which is, I think, quicker than I would have hoped for. I wouldn't have expected so many people in so little time to step down. And I think that they, you know, there was a stable administration for 8 years before, and that when all of a sudden there's change, it makes people nervous. And I understand that. But as I said, if people have concerns, I really would like to talk to them and resolve their concerns.
When you look at UW, and you've obviously had several weeks and a couple of months to look at this, do you see a need for major culture change here?
I don't know whether you would call it major culture change. I can't speak very clearly to what was done under the previous administration because I wasn't here. Rather, I think that my focus is on ethical leadership development, which is our land grant mission, and it's also on our flagship mission of excelling in research, just having a great research program, teaching, superb teaching, and outreach and extension, that we reach out to people in the state and help them, whether it's in agriculture or business or engineering or whatever. So I can't say what came before me, but those are some of the emphases I would hope others would share.
And if I'm listening to you right now, no matter where I am in the state of Wyoming, why shouldn't I be concerned? I mean, you're obviously reading news articles, you're hearing conversation coming out of the university. Why shouldn't I be worried that there's maybe a little turmoil going down in Laramie?
I've been here 4 months, and I would hope that people would not rush to judgment, especially without engaging me. I mean, what concerns me some is that there's a lot of chatter. I understand that. But if people have concerns, and some do, I'm almost always on email. I answer my own emails, and I answer them quickly. I don't turn down anyone for appointments, anyone who wants to meet with me. I'll meet with them. I live across the street at 1120 Ivinson Street. Anyone can come ring the door. My cell phone is, you know, available to anyone who wants it. Anyone who wants to get in contact with me, it's very easy to do.
University of Wyoming President Bob Sternberg, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about the state's revenue picture and talk with Wyoming's Occupational Health and Safety Administrator about how his office is working to prevent more accidents at the Sinclair Refinery. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. The main revenue forecasting arm for the state of Wyoming called 2013 a solid year economically. Thanks to investments, it means the state raised almost $350 million over projections. But the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, or CREG, says while this is great news, problems may be on the horizon. The legislative committee tasked with developing the state's budget wants to be cautious. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
The Joint Appropriations Committee is tasked with developing the next two-year budget that will fund state government. When the CREG report first came out, Governor Matt Mead viewed it as positive and was pleased that the state would not have to go through the exercise of cutting budgets as it did in the last few years. He also urged legislators to spend some money on things such as raises for state employees and on one-time projects such as roads. But legislators saw their revenue picture change dramatically when the economy tanked in 2008, and they are far from comfortable yet. In fact, some, like Campbell County Representative Sue Wallace, says that the state needs to tread lightly.
It looks better, certainly, than it has. But nonetheless, our long-term projections are still troubling.
We don't see the revenue supporting the growth of government where we are now, 2, 3, 4, 5 years out.
That's Eli Bebout, the co-chairman of the committee. Bebout has been around. He served when the state's revenues busted in the 80s and 90s and was there when cuts were made in the last few years. He's a player in the energy industry and knows how the boom and bust cycle works. While there is hope that increasing oil production can make a significant impact in the state, he says federal regulations are making it difficult on all extractive industries. Since Wyoming gets most of its money from energy, he's nervous about a lot of new spending. Bebout is not interested in reversing the cuts to government that lawmakers made in recent years, but he concedes some spending is okay.
If we'd be reasonable, we could stay within a good, responsible standard budget. I think we can see our way through this, and who knows, things may turn around, and we might have, you know, we might be okay.
But Bebout also knows the state has some spending it must address. He says health care issues will still be a budget concern, and he says there is a tremendous need to spend more money for those getting developmental disability assistance and, of course, the ongoing concern over education spending. Lawmakers seem particularly spooked over that last piece. Coal is projected to bring in less revenue for the state, and that could have a dramatic impact on education funding. Casper Representative Tim Stubson says changing markets and new regulations have been tough on the coal industry, and he says it is already having an impact. The state is already expected to be down close to $300 million in school capital construction money next year.
All these great schools we've built across the state have been funded by coal, and it's been those coal lease bonus monies that have done it. And you have this situation over the last few months where one coal lease wasn't bid on at all, one was rejected, and so this whole stream of revenue that we've been relying upon seems to be drying up. And so we have some real serious thinking to do about how we continue to fund education, especially capital construction in the future.
Stubson says the fear is that they'd have to raise taxes to pay for it. Another fund that gives him concern is the retirement fund for state employees that needs a serious infusion of cash to keep it safe in the future. Employees and employers will be asked to pay more, but Stubson says it might not be enough. Lawmakers have saved money recently in hopes of having enough to pay for 1 to 2 years of government. Some, like Senator John Hastert of Green River, say they shouldn't squirrel away so much money.
You know, we have to save. Savings is important, but do we have the right amount of savings and money working for people? And my opinion is I think we need to have a little more working for the people of Wyoming.
University of Wyoming economist Ann Alexander says that the revenue picture looks good, not great, but far from dire. She says cuts certainly aren't needed, but agrees that lawmakers should be cautious. But Alexander says they should address some important needs.
We're at a point now where some of the things that we've had to put off because we needed to be cautious about natural gas prices and coal and so on, we can't put them off forever because they're going to take a bigger investment if we keep putting them off. And so, for example, if you think about highway spending.
Alexander says they are looking at slow, steady revenue growth in the future, so she says it is time to focus on what they need and put their money there. The Appropriations Committee will receive the governor's proposed budget soon and will start looking at priorities in December. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
A few weeks ago, the Sinclair Wyoming Refining Company got a $707,000 fine for safety violations. Wyoming's Occupational Health and Safety Administration, or OSHA, found that Sinclair had willfully violated various safety regulations and failed to fix hazards that could have resulted in death or serious physical harm. The refinery has had a series of accidents over the past few years and has been fined multiple times. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden spoke with OSHA's John Eisbert. He says this latest fine was meant to be a wake-up call to show Sinclair that it needs to clean up its act.
OSHA fines work on an escalating basis. And so given the pattern of safety violations that they've had in the past few years, they're at the point of really the top rung of the citation level. This is the largest fine that Wyoming OSHA has ever issued, bar any employer. And so we really are trying to communicate that this is an extremely serious situation for us.
Sinclair has had problem after problem after problem in the last few years. We've had fires, we've had explosions, we've had releases of toxic gases, we've had workers end up in the hospital for injuries. Why do these things continue to happen at Sinclair when they're not happening to the same extent at other refineries?
What has been shown from all the inspections that we've done here in the last few years is that they were significantly behind on physical plant issues. They had a dated physical plant. They had a significant turnover on staff, on their entry-level staff, their operators. Those combined for a pretty dire situation in terms of safety.
When are these problems going to stop?
Willow, I wish I could tell you. I wish I could predict that for you. We have a consultation team over there at least once a month, but generally speaking, much more frequent than that. We've also required them to bring in some external independent safety contractors to perform some additional inspections. One of the things that they've done is to join the what's called the Wyoming Refinery Safety Alliance. It's a consortium of the refineries in the state, all the different refineries in the state, and they're trying to look at common issues and come together solely on safety issues. They do have a lot going on, but they have a tremendous amount of progress to make. They, as I said, they were significantly behind. But I wish I could predict that for you.
Well, and we've spoken often in the last couple of years about the issues at Sinclair, and in pretty much every interview, you've mentioned some of these things that Sinclair is doing to try to fix the problems, but the problems keep happening. I mean, there was a fire in July, there was an explosion in September, so is any of this actually helping?
Well, I do think it is. The number of injuries has reduced since that involvement, but you know, Willow, a refinery is a very dangerous place. They have so many different processes and critical processes going on at any one time. When you see these reports of the, you know, like this most recent explosion, it looks like nothing is getting done, but they are making progress.
Now, you said refineries are inherently dangerous places, which of course they are, but we don't see all the other refineries exploding all the time and catching fire. So, I mean, is that really an excuse?
No, this certainly is not an excuse. And that is exactly what we look at. We look at, you know, we have these other refineries that don't have these issues, yet at Sinclair we do, and we have repeated safety issues and concerns. And really, as we look at it, it is a culture of safety that, you know, if I were to generalize it in any one way, there is a difference in the culture of safety between that plant and the others.
What do you think that's coming from? I mean, what creates a culture of safety in some plants versus a lack of that in a place like Sinclair?
To really boil that down, leadership.
So in other words, the people that Sinclair hires at the top.
And all the way through the management ranks.
So if the issue here, if a lot of the issue is a lack of a culture of safety, which is coming from people at the top, essentially, can we expect them to fix the problems if they don't change the leadership?
You know, that really isn't something I can answer. I do know that they have made some leadership changes. Their plant manager is new, and their operations manager is new.
So now, just since 2011, OSHA has given Sinclair more than 180 safety violations, which is a lot, and some of these are for repeat violations for serious problems. So that sort of suggests that, okay, maybe the fines up until now haven't been working, and if that's the case, couldn't we just shut down the refinery until they actually address these issues?
The issue of shutdown does come up. Trust me when I say that issue is out there and is on the table.
Is there a specific set of events that would have to happen in order for you to be able to call for a shutdown? I mean, does somebody have to die? Does what needs to happen in order for the plant to actually get shut down?
You know, there aren't any prescribed events that would have to happen in order to have a shutdown. It would come in terms of our judgment that a shutdown was the measure of last resort.
So we've got, I mean, you just issued a higher fine than OSHA's ever issued. If you go back later and do another inspection and find that they still haven't fixed some of these problems, would a shutdown be in order at that point, or would it just be even more fines?
You know, it would really depend what the substance of those issues would be. And we really would look at what's the likelihood of a serious injury or fatality.
In general, how optimistic are you that things are going to get better at the refinery soon?
You know, we have, in the last 2 weeks, we have had a real series of meetings with their corporate executives, from their CEO to their top safety. They've just hired a new safety official there, Susan Sharp, and we've met with them a number of times, but three times with their corporate executives. And I'm very optimistic that they will get things turned around. I do see the commitment from their leadership team in terms of funding for the changes that need to be made, as well as for the issues that need to be in place to achieve that culture of safety.
Okay, well, John, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden talking with John Eisbart. He's the head of Wyoming OSHA.
Coming up, Converse County residents wrestle with planning for oil and gas development, and a story from a man who was a prisoner of war. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. Converse County is one of six counties in Wyoming with no land use regulations. When a proposal to develop zoning came up a decade ago, it went nowhere. But as development associated with the oil and gas boom in the Niobrara explodes, the county is struggling with questions of how to make sure it happens responsibly. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, some residents are starting to question the costs of not planning.
On a nice day, it would be a quick walk from Bob Kaiser's ranch to the site of the proposed natural gas processing facility. But on this icy, foggy morning, we opt for a drive instead. Kaiser's ranch and the proposed plant site are both on State Highway 91, a two-lane road with no shoulder just outside of Douglas city limits.
Here's where the plant site is. It's right under this. See this? There's not even a flat area, but it's slightly flat.
It looks exactly like the rest of the ranch land surrounding it. But if the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality grants Jackalope Gas the air quality permit it's waiting on, that patch of pasture could turn into a massive industrial complex by the end of the year. Kaiser and his neighbors are worried about emissions, increased truck traffic, spills, and the general disruption to the agricultural community.
In this case, the neighbors are going to experience the negative effects, but have no financial interest in it at all. You need to be careful when you do that kind of thing.
But back in his office, where a copy of Oil and Gas Investor magazine sits on a desk, he says he isn't against the plant's development.
But you need to do it right.
Kaiser has lots of ideas about how the plant could be a better neighbor, but getting the company to hear his ideas has been a challenge.
The problem is, without a regulatory encouragement, they don't have to talk to us.
Crestwood, the lead on the project, didn't make anyone available to be interviewed for this story either. But the company did host a public meeting in Douglas in October to explain the project and hear the community's concerns. Like Kaiser, many residents went to the meeting not just with complaints, but with potential solutions. One landowner even tried independent zoning, offering to trade a piece of land he owned in a more industrialized part of town in exchange for the current site. But that offer might have just shifted the problem. Jennifer Bain lives down the road from the property that was offered for trade and next to a rail loading facility that Crestwood and another company built earlier this year. She says she didn't even know it was going to be built until they broke ground.
It's just a free-for-all.
And Bain says people are starting to realize that no one is safe from the forward march of development.
Instead of it just being north of town and east of town, now it's south of town and west of town, and everybody is being impacted.
Repeating a popular Converse County refrain, Bain says she doesn't want to stop the development. She just wants it done right. Jim Willex is the chair of the Converse County Board of Commissioners. He says without zoning, the county has no leverage to get companies to cooperate and no way to ensure that people's concerns are addressed.
As always in this situation, it's more of we're asking you to help us. It's not we don't have a therefore if you don't.
And Willex doesn't necessarily want one. Like many residents of the county, he prefers cooperation to regulation. But he acknowledges that as development ramps up, conflicts are bound to increase.
Every project goes in somebody's backyard.
Alan Romero is director of the Rural Law Center at the University of Wyoming, and he studies land use planning. He says while zoning has its pros and cons, it gives citizens the chance to make their own decisions about how they want their town to develop.
How can we direct this activity in a way that will minimize those adverse impacts?
But Romero says state law pretty clearly prohibits counties from restricting where mineral extraction and production can happen. Zoning can be used, though, to regulate how it's done.
How you extract or how you produce, which could include where you place buildings, how far it's set back from the site. It could even include things to mitigate noise and dust and aesthetic issues, visual mitigation of various sorts.
But Romero will be the first to tell you that working out those details can be a complicated and costly process. And in any event, it's not on the table in Converse County. Kaiser, the rancher, says it's unlikely that the residents would be willing to take a unified approach to planning anytime soon.
It's a dilemma between unfettered personal freedom and having other people come in and decide how your community and how your county is going to be developed.
So whether residents choose to zone or not, they'll have to give up something. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
In her 9 years as superintendent of Grand Teton National Park, Mary Gibson Scott has overseen a number of park improvements from transportation to a new visitor center. But issues from funding for parks to protecting wildlife continue to be a concern. Gibson Scott retires this weekend, so we asked her about a few key issues, such as reforming the Endangered Species Act.
Well, you know, I think the Endangered Species Act is good. I think that it's the test of its success is being able to delist a species. And I know that there were some starts and stops with wolf delisting, and of course that's presented us with a problem in the parkway as to the need to petition to promulgate regulations was presented by NPCA to our new secretary. So to protect wolves and grizzly bears in the parkway from hunting under the state permit. So, you know, I was a chair of the Yellowstone subcommittee of the grizzly bear conservation, and we are taking very careful steps in understanding what the population effects are on grizzly bears. And the conservation strategy that we've been using, all of the land management agencies throughout this ecosystem, is, I think, one of the best written documents, and it allows for management flexibility in the future as we move through to potential delisting. So when you have a conservation plan as well done as that for grizzly bears, I think it's a good law, and I think it's a good plan. Now, politics, of course, there will be politics associated with all delistings and with all management actions we take. So, but I think the grizzly bear is worth a lot of discussion because it is an iconic species worthy of preservation.
Is it time, though, to take it off that list, do you think?
You know, I really can't speculate. I've been involved up until April of this year, deep into the demographics and population modeling and all the aspects of food sources. So I was the outgoing chair. So I haven't continued that, but I'll be monitoring it in the future. And I will be, monitoring the April meeting in Jackson to understand where we're heading with that.
One of the stories we did with you a while back was certainly this access part of the transportation plan and part of getting around the park was adding those bike paths. And you had expressed some concern about that when that started. There was a few worries about impacts. Do you still share those concerns? Are there still some things you're worried about, or maybe has that been a success?
Well, the pathways have been an incredible success. We've known all along they would be. The question is, should they be everywhere? And I think in the areas where they've been developed, the first several phases, you know, to town connecting to South Ginny Lake, that's all open sage, very visible, easy grades. Those we knew would be incredible successes. Do they have impacts? Yes, they have effects. You have displacement further away from the pathway of pronghorn. You had some changes in some species-specific nesting behavior and all that. You know, so those we understand, and those did occur. I think when you get into discussions about where you go further north, as well as some of the discussions that have led to the need to relook at Moose Wilson, those are questions that become a little bit more problematic in understanding what effects there might be, the impacts on a tremendous wildlife corridor, unlike any other within Grand Teton, and making sure that we do the right thing as we move into the future of Moose Wilson.
Moose Wilson is certainly, as you leave, is probably going to be it strikes me as maybe the next big controversy for the locals. Would you just maybe explain to folks why you're a little worried about that stretch?
Well, because it's an incredibly rich wildlife corridor, because, we have grizzly bears throughout that area. We've always had black bears, but grizzly bears have been there for several years. It's also because of the amount of tree cover and the potential for unintentionally coming upon wildlife, whether it's a moose, cow, calf, which is just as dangerous as a grizzly bear with cub. When you are going quietly along a bike path, I think the real issue with Moose Wilson is, what is the future for Grand Teton? I know some of what was remarked last fall when this became a hot issue was any change to Moose Wilson and its traffic direction and vehicles would be a detractant to it was said that there would be a profound economic effect on the county as a result of changing some of the traffic patterns on Moose Wilson. And, stepping back, one of the first things that struck me when I arrived here was what an incredibly beautiful scenic drive it is now and how easy it is to see wildlife. So, we're not responsible for the economic health of the community, but we're certainly concerned about it. But that wasn't the purpose for which Grand Teton was created. And
as you look at just the park as a whole, as you step down, I'm curious what kind of concerns still remain out there as far as you're concerned.
Well, state lands. I've lost more sleep about state lands than any of the issues combined. We've been working on this very actively since 2004. We were able to get an agreement in 2010 with then-Governor Friedenthal about the plan for acquisition, and we acquired 86 acres last December, which was no small feat, given it was $16 million, the largest land acquisition I have ever done in my career. And so, this is a very difficult, challenging fiscal climate we're in, and I think, we'll be looking, I'll be looking to the governor and the state of Wyoming and the Secretary of the Interior, who has taken this on as an issue, to work through the next steps, which involve 1,280 acres and $91 million. We need to really put our heads down and work on it and look for nonpartisan solutions of how we can resolve giving that value to the state of Wyoming and making the park whole, which has been an issue for 75 years.
Mary Gibson Scott, we do wish you well in the future, and thank you for joining us on Open Spaces.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Veterans Day is coming up, and we're going to hear veteran Ted Gostis tell his wife, Jody Gostis, about being taken as a prisoner of war in the Vietnam War and his years in solitary confinement. Gostis remained a POW for 5 years, 5 months, and 15 days. Of those captured in northern Vietnam, he was one of only four POWs to stay in solitary confinement for more than 4 years.
Solitary confinement is an awesome experience because you don't know what's going to happen next first. And my cell was only about 7 feet high by 4 feet wide. And I had a blanket and a mosquito net and a pair of old stocks that they used to, like the medieval stocks. You could lift them up and put a person's feet in them, clasp it down, and then lock it. And I had a spoon, and I was in a very dire straits all most of the time because I couldn't correspond with anybody. So I was completely alone, so I tried to think of things to keep my sanity, stories, anything I could think of. I started to sing to myself, make up songs, do anything I could, but it always kept slipping away like sliding down a mountainside, and I knew I was going insane, and I didn't want to. I didn't want to go insane at all. Nobody wants to go insane. But it was slipping away from me, and every time I'd think of something, I'd think of taking my wife, at that time my first wife, to a flower store, buying her a bouquet of flowers, and then walking down the street. And then 3 months later, I'd try to reconstruct that story, and I'd be throwing her through the window and eating the flowers and all kinds of bizarre things. So I knew I was losing it. And eventually, I actually, through psychological torture combined with physical torture, went completely insane, and it took a long time to get me back to sanity.
I have a very special request, and that is for you to tell the story, if you can, of your gold tooth.
When I went to Greece with my father, he was aware that I was going to go to the Greek-American school there. My mother had ordered him to do that, to leave me there so I could learn the Greek language. But he was kind of a penny pincher, and every time we'd go to a dentist, the dentist would say he wanted 200 drachmas or 500 drachmas. I had two front teeth that were supposed to be made into partials because they were missing. I had fallen and broken both of them as younger. And so he kept taking me to a doctor that he felt met his budget. When we got down to 40 drachmas, the doctor said, "I have no Novocaine, but I can do the job." And he started in, and I screamed so loud I ran out of the office. Then I ran back to my father, grabbed the airplane tickets, and went by myself to Swiss Air and flew home. And my mother was furious, said, "You were supposed to stay in Greece." I said, "I'm not going to stay with him." The doctor had almost finished his work in Greece, that is. And what he had done was had the jeweler come up from the street to make gold fittings to my two front teeth to clasp them into my mouth. And I forgot all about him. The communists didn't see him. They didn't care about that, but they took everything else from me, ring, watch, billfold, everything I had. And I had nothing that was familiar to me. So being in solitary confinement for 4.5 years, one of only four prisoners who were in solitary confinement for more than 4 years, I started to lose my mind, and I knew I was going insane. And one day I was sitting in my cell, and I looked at my hands. I had clasped them in front of me, and all of a sudden I saw gold, and I thought, somebody up there loves me. They're sending me gold to bribe a guard to let me go or something. And I looked down and I found out that due to malnutrition, mouth had shrunk and the teeth had fallen out. Those two little gold backings had fallen out. I picked them up and it said Epta Dromo, seven-something street, Athens, Greece. And that brought me back to reality for a time, that I knew I had an identity and that these teeth were indicative of that. And I used them very carefully because the guards would check to see everything that was in the prisoner's cell. And I used to cut my fingernails with the edge of the gold teeth partial that had fallen out. And the guards were always wondering when they came in to cut my fingernails, which sometimes would go below the quick, how I had my nails always so nice. So they'd grab my hand and they'd say that it had been cut and they'd leave. But then one day they discovered that I had this class when they took it from me.
That was Ted Gostis talking to his wife, Jody Gostis. The piece was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov with the interviews recorded at StoryCorps. StoryCorps is a national nonprofit whose mission is to provide Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs with the opportunity to record, share, and preserve the stories of our lives.
Coming up, we'll visit a company that's figured out new ways to identify unknown substances, and we'll take you to a square dance. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Irina Zhorov. In our occasional Upstart series, we're going to visit a company called Snowy Range Instruments. It's based in Laramie, and it makes devices that can identify mystery substances. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
In a large warehouse-like room, Tony Eads sits hunched over a workbench. He's holding a soldering iron and working on the control board for a high-tech instrument. At this stage, the device looks kind of like what you might see if you took apart a computer, basically a green board with a maze of tiny copper-colored components.
So now I'm just going to lay a piece of solder on one of the pads here.
When it's finished, the instrument will be able to identify unknown chemical and biological substances. Keith Karen is the president of Snowy Range Instruments, the company that makes the devices. He shows me one of the finished products. It's a blue, palm-sized device with a small door at the top. He picks up a glass vial containing a white powder and slides it into the opening.
This is a sample. So this could be the unknown.
So what are you putting in there? What is this?
Well, we're going to see what it says. I'm not going to tell you.
In the time it took him to say that, the instrument has analyzed the substance and identified what it is. The answer blinks onto the screen.
It's TNT.
In other words, an explosive material. Karen says there are lots of uses for devices like this.
Let's say a truck crashes on Highway 80 and it's not clear what the truck is carrying. We can go in with our little devices and analyze it and tell you what's inside, whether it's hazardous or not.
That information could help emergency responders figure out how to proceed. Until recently, to identify unknown materials, you had to send samples to a lab and use an array of different technologies to analyze them. Now, this one small device can do everything all at once on site. A handful of companies across the U.S. now market devices similar to the one Snowy Range Instruments makes, but Karen was a pioneer in developing the technology. It all started as a result of research he was doing at the University of Wyoming. Karen was and still is a chemistry professor there. At the time, he was developing ways to test water for pollutants, and he was frustrated by the size of the equipment that was available.
When I came here in 1988, my instrumentation was the size of a Volkswagen.
That meant he couldn't take it into the field, and he says having to transport samples back to the lab sometimes affected his results.
That was one of the reasons I started this company, is to have field portable instruments.
Karen's business has been growing steadily. He has more than a dozen employees and expects to sell about 100 instruments this year. That might not sound like a lot, but each device costs at least $15,000, so there's substantial revenue coming in. His clients range from universities to the military. Karen says the Army is hoping to use his instruments to find out if chemical warfare agents are being used, for example, in places like Syria. Another client is focused on disease detection. That company plans to use Snowy Range devices in Africa to test people for malaria. Karen says this way they won't have to send blood samples off to a lab, so they'll get instant results.
The way it's currently done, it's cheaper to buy the medicine for malaria than to have the test. And so they end up getting treated for a disease they don't have and not being diagnosed for the disease they do have.
Industries closer to home also have uses for the instruments Karen sells.
A lot of the recent applications are in oil and gas.
That's Mark Peterman, the president of a company called Ondavia. Ondavia buys devices from Snowy Range Instruments and adds on an extra attachment that helps detect contaminants in water samples.
So being able to test water at a wellhead, if let's say you're in the middle, you're doing some fracking operations, or being able to test at a refinery to make sure that everything is at the right levels. Right now, that requires taking a sample and shipping it to a lab and waiting. We can do that testing with a Snowy Range system, and our cartridges, we can do it on site. So it can be done right at the wellhead or right at the refinery.
Tom Johnson with the Wyoming Business Council says businesses like Snowy Range Instruments are really good for the local economy. They provide jobs for highly skilled engineers, and they sell their goods mostly to out-of-state buyers.
So if you think of your community in Laramie in this case as an economic pie, if you will, when you export a good or service outside of the economy, you bring new money in, which increases in theory, the economic pie for everybody.
And he says when companies like this succeed in a place like Laramie, that encourages even more entrepreneurs, which in turn creates more jobs and helps diversify the economy. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Several times a year, Laramie hosts square dances that attract dancers from hundreds of miles around. Part of the draw is the hall, which is on the National Register of Historic Places. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer has a postcard from Laramie's Quadradangle Square Dance Club.
Okay, full disclosure, my wife and I are taking lessons at the Quadradangle. This summer, we were driving around town, getting our bearings after moving to Laramie, and the massive pine log hall made me step hard on the brakes. It was built by the Union Pacific Railway Company in 1928 as an athletic club. The UP used its expertise constructing bridges to build a 60-foot open span inside with a smooth hardwood floor underfoot.
The floor is great, the acoustics is great, and great people, and it just is a fun time.
Judy Strobel and her husband Lynn traveled from Miles City, Montana for a recent dance.
Rustic. It's kind of got a rustic appearance. Yeah.
Are there a lot of other clubs like this one?
No. This is an unusual hall. Yeah. It makes it kind of special.
In many places, square dances happen in community centers and multi-purpose rooms with tile or concrete floors. Here, feet glide across the rich wood floor, and dancers are surrounded by the log hall's frontier ambiance. In 1949, Union Pacific sold the hall called Gray's Gables. It became the Quadradangle. Today, nobody seems to quite know what the name means. The newly formed club offered the low bid, but promised to maintain UP's prohibition of drinking and, quote, rowdyism. All the same, the annual big dances are pretty lively. More than a dozen squares of four couples each follow the caller's lead. Dancers come from Wyoming, of course, but also Montana, Colorado, and beyond, drawn by the unique hall. Jerry Tietzma is from Granby, Colorado.
We love just the friendship and the great hall. The wood floor, it's a great place to dance.
But Quadradangle caller Dave Giel points out a challenge.
Our square dancing group are becoming aged, and I don't mean that to be critical, but they are. They're getting up in years, and we're not finding young people to come in and take those places.
There are exceptions, like 11-year-old DJ from Rollins, who's been dancing for about a year, and this 16-year-old.
I'm Andrea, and I'm from here in Laramie. My parents have been square dancing for a really long time, and that's how they met, and I just thought it would be good to try and get younger people in.
Andrea also does hip-hop and point dancing, but what do her peers think of square dancing?
Well, I'll tell them that I square dance, and they're like, no way. I'll be like, yeah, way. So they think it's different, but I just try to embrace it.
Yancey Allison is a caller at another club, the Rollins Promenaders. He says some people get hung up on the image of square dancing.
You know, the girls have to wear the fancy dress. I have to wear the cowboy shirt. I don't want to wear that stuff. I tell people no. In fact, I know a square dance caller that calls wearing a tie-dye shirt, Bermuda shorts, and flip-flops.
At the weekly lessons, I've found square dancing to be about more than just learning calls like the do-si-do, grand square, and California twirl. It's also about forming new friendships and being part of local culture. The hardwood floor is now 85 years old. It's had the last sanding and refinishing it can take, but it still has life in it. With renewed community interest and some younger dancers, so does the Quadradangle Square Dance Club. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Micah Schweitzer.
The next Open Community Dance is on January 16th, with lessons starting on January 23rd.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again, listen to individual segments, or listen to previous episodes, you can go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and click on Open Spaces.
You can also submit ideas for future programs on that website and comment on our stories. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and you can find all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.